Matthew 25 is where we want to pick up with tonight, specifically Matthew 25, verses 37 through 40. This is the section of the chapter where Jesus talks about the sheep and the goats, what will happen with people at the end of time as far as the righteous and the unrighteous. We have, beginning back with verse 31, talked about his coming, how he will be on the throne, and as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, the righteous will be on the right hand, the unrighteous will be on the left, and then Jesus will say to the righteous, "Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and ye gave me to eat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me to drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me." Then, new material, Matthew 25, verses 37 to 40. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, "Lord, when saw we thee hungry and fed thee, or athirst and gave thee drink? And when saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? And when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto me?" And the king shall answer and say unto them, "Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it unto one of these my brethren, even these least, ye did it unto me." As people, as Christians, go through their individual lives, you think they, over the years, forget about some of the things that they do? Others may remember those things, but as we go through our lives, if we're an active Christian, there's probably a whole lot that we do in our lives that we can't remember. It's not unlike a parent. You think a parent? You've raised a child, or you've raised children over a period of 18 or maybe 20 or 30 years, you remember all the stuff that you did? No way. Now, you might remember a few nights, there might have been a trip to the hospital, or maybe there was a trip to the jail or something else. That those things really stick out in your minds. But for the most part, you know, it's just a lifelong process during those formative years for children and so forth. Well, even though we may forget, we know that Christians are to be zealous of good works, Titus 2, verse 14, and that certainly includes the saints, Galatians 6, verse 10. But Hebrews 6, 10 says that God is not unrighteous to forget the works that we do. Thus, even though the picture is here in Matthew 25, we may have forgotten some of the good things, or maybe most of the good things that we've done, God has remembered those things for us, and they will be one of the things that somehow factors in to the judgment. When you think about some passages that we've looked at recently, we've talked about Revelation 14, verse 13. That passage says, "Their works follow them." Now, John didn't get real specific as far as how that works, but this, to me, seems to be one example of that, that God is still mindful of what his people did when it is time for people to be sentenced to eternity in heaven or in hell. And then you, I think, could also tie into this, 2 Corinthians 8, 5. We oftentimes refer to 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 9, as far as the giving that God's people do. 2 Corinthians 8, 5 talks about the giving first of themselves. It wasn't just money, it was a willingness to serve. It was a willingness to be used in God's service. And once again, that decision, that choice, and the acts that follow will have some bearing on eternity. Then we come to this other point. Jesus says, when you did it unto one of these, the least, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Ultimately, who did you do it to?
Him.
Is there a passage in the book of Acts, or actually a couple places where we find this, but is there a passage, a point in the book of Acts, which repeats the principle that we have here? A guy by the name of Saul, what was he doing? All right, he was persecuting God's people. Then he has that meeting, Acts 9, 4 is one example of this. And the voice from heaven says, "Saul, Saul, why persecute who?
Me."
Well, who was Saul persecuting?
Jesus.
Well, he was persecuting the Christians. But the connection between Christ and his people is so close. Remember how Paul describes it? Christ is the head of what? The church, the people. So if you are affecting God's people in a positive way or a negative way, what are you also doing? You're affecting Christ. So if you hurt God's people, you're hurting Christ. In the case of Saul, we see that demonstrated quite well. And if you're looking at it from the other side, that is, you're trying to help God's people, then once again, you are also helping Christ. Then Jesus says, when you did it unto one of these, the least of these, my brethren. Do you think there are some least people in the church? Okay. All right. All right. A novice, the people who perhaps have not been members very long. Anything else that we can add to that? That's a good answer. The least in the church. Don?
Well, when you said this the last time, like
couldn't wrap my arms around it.
Which part?
Well, it says you did it to one of these, of the least of these, my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, he's saying the least, and then you can put a comma there, it says my brothers, talking about the righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the least of the brothers, it's the least of anybody.
Well, I think you could make that point. There are some people who look at this in a very universal way as far as helping the poor. And that point is true as far as, you know, Galatians 6:10. So then as we have opportunity, let's work that which is good to who? To all men. But then he says especially the household of faith. So you do have in the Bible both of those things. The word brethren here inclines me to put more attention on the saved, but I would not exclude the others as well. Brian?
It reminds me of the comparison to John the Baptist, that the least in the kingdom was greater than him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like anybody in the church.
Okay. Yeah, I think that is true as well. But is there still something else that we can add here? The least of the brethren. Well, all right, you can include that. In a local congregation, do you have some people that maybe seem a little more prominent than others? I mean, local congregation has elders. People talk about the elders, or they talk about the preacher, or they talk about the Bible class teacher, or they talk about the people who have been members of the church for a long time, or those that, you know, are involved in various activities. But most congregations have some people that would fall into, if you will, and this is not to demean them or to say anything bad about them, but they are the least, don't they? What if you've got the shut-in? Hasn't been able to come out to worship for 10 years. She a member of the church?
Yes.
Yeah. Would you say that she is the least? Well, she'd probably fall into that particular category. And there are some other people. So Jesus says, even for those people that may not be as visible as others, even the people who may not, you know, receive as much attention as others, those people still need to be cared for. And when they are, God takes notice. One of the things, and I'll mention this and then see if there's some other things that you want to describe, a little unusual. Anybody have the King James translation? All right, you want to read verse 37?
Verse 37?
Uh-huh.
Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee a hungry?
There it is. When saw we thee what?
Hungry.
And hungered. Well, that doesn't sound very good, does it? And hungered. So that's just one of those quirks of the King James translation. They could have struck the word "and" out of there and it would have been perfectly fine. But with an older translation, sometimes you see those things. So as you're reading carefully, you might think, huh, well, that looks a little odd. That's a 1611 King James?
It's a brand new King James.
You said 37?
37.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay, that's a new. The New King James. Right. They went ahead and looked at that and said, okay, let's knock off that little bit of a rough edge. No, but if you get the King James, just the regular King James, you'll find that word "and." But I didn't know that the New King James tidied that up a bit, so that's good to know. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we said from verses 37 to 40? Okay. Let's move ahead then and pick up verse 41. Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into the eternal fire, which is prepared for the devil and his angels. When time ends, and everybody stands before the Lord's throne, there will be two groups of people. Some will be saved, others will be lost. We studied about this a little bit in Revelation chapter 14. In that chapter, as you get down towards the end of it, we described how John pictures Jesus. He's the one who collects the righteous. And we also see in John, this is going to be in verses 17 through 20 of Revelation 14. Angelic power is going to be used to collect the unrighteous. Do you remember from the end of Revelation 14, as the angels collect the unrighteous, the comparison that's used, where are the unrighteous people put? What are they compared to? They're compared to what fruit? Grapes. And grapes that are squeezed, pressed, crushed. And that's not a very attractive image, but that's exactly what John says in Revelation 14. John That illustration could have been repeated here, but Jesus uses a different illustration. What's he say? First word. He says, you depart. You go. You leave. You have to be freed from my presence. You have to be put into a different spot. And then he describes the people as what? You are cursed. And then he also goes on to say what else? You need to depart where? You need to go into the eternal, or you need to go into the everlasting fire. And then he says, this place or this state has been prepared, and prepared for whom? The devil and his angels. Now, it's one thing to be told to depart. That's scary. Especially when God is the one saying, you've got to leave my presence. And how long are you going to have to leave it for? For it's going to be an eternal separation. It's going to be forever. There is no coming back. And then John says, or Matthew says some other things I think that are interesting. We discussed this Monday at a preacher's meeting. John says, or Matthew says, I keep wanting to say John. Matthew says, the Lord will tell these people, you've been cursed. Now, we've talked before about the tense of verbs. And here is a place where I think the tense is significant. Jesus will say, you've been cursed, perfect tense. Now, let that sink in for just a second. Perfect tense, what's that mean? Something was true. All right, in the past or before, and that state continues. Well, you could look at this in a couple of different ways. Whichever way, if Jesus intended just one way, I don't know which that was, but certainly both points are true. When you think about people who refuse to obey God, are they not in a state of condemnation? Yeah. I mean, we either walk in the light and we continue to be in a right relationship with God, or we don't walk in the light and we continue to be in a wrong relationship with God. There are only two choices, unless we are not accountable for our actions. So here he says, you're cursed, perfect tense. But there may be something else going on. And we'll not get into all this, but the book of Ephesians does a pretty good job. When you think about salvation, is it right, is it biblical to say that God has selected two classes? He said that there's going to be a class, there's going to be a group for the unrighteous. And their destination was going to be heaven. And God says we're also going to have a class for the unrighteous. And their destination is going to be heaven. Or their destination is going to be hell. Would you say that that's correct? That's the impression that you get from the book of Ephesians. And you see that, for example, no, I'm not going to do that. It'd just get us too far off base. But anyway, you do find things as far as individual statements about predestination, if you will, and that still is something that man makes a choice about. God simply knew. We've talked before about Revelation two times in that book, depending on your translation. There's one time that is a manuscript variation. But names, John says, were written from when? From the beginning, from the foundation of the world. And you can tie that in here with what we find in Matthew chapter 25. The people who choose to be in the unrighteous group, that group God has selected for condemnation. The people who choose to be part of the group that is obedient to God, they have been selected. They've been chosen to be saved. Anything that you want to say on either of those items before we move through the text a little bit more? Ray?
I'm just, when he says depart from me, the eternal fire, I'm reminded of Adam and Eve when they were driven out of the garden. Now that was going to be forever too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when God talks about forever or everlasting, in that sense, you do have some examples in the Old Testament. For example, if you're going to possess a land forever, olam is the Hebrew word, and that word can be understood in various ways. But in the New Testament, as we deal with forever, eternal, those kinds of things, it does mean that it's an ongoing action. And that's scary, because if you're on the right side of it, that's good, but if you're on the wrong side of it, there is no chance to go back and reverse that or clean that up or, you know, change your state. So, yeah, it is. Sherman?
Are you going to discuss fire, or are we past that
fire? No, we're not past it yet. So if there's some things that you want to tie in after we get to that point, that'll be perfectly fine. But there's a lot here in 41, so I want to kind of take things step by step. And I've got in my notes. This is a verse that I think merits a lot of attention for multiple reasons. First of all, you do find that the unsaved are going to spend eternity with some angels. But they're not going to be the angels that people want to spend eternity with, as far as the unsaved. Righteous people will be in heaven. They'll be with the good people, the good angels, the unrighteous people. They not only get to spend eternity with the unrighteous angels, but who else? The devil. So it's going to be a very interesting eternity for them. Now, when Jesus makes these points, would you say that the Lord affirmed the truthfulness, the realness of Satan? He says, hell's been prepared for whom? The devil. Well, what does that say about the realness of Satan? He is real. He's not some myth, as people have sometimes alleged. And then Jesus, as he talks about hell and what's going to happen with the devil, he says that Satan's going to spend eternity in what kind of fire? It is an everlasting, it is an eternal fire, which Ray mentioned just a moment ago. It's not going to go out, it's not going to cease, and this is going to be for Satan plus his angels. I can't say with 100% certainty, but I'm about 99.9% certain that the devil's angels are the same creatures that Jude talked about in Jude 6, and also what Peter talked about in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. There were the angels that fell, and the Bible says that these angels have been chained. They're the unrighteous angels, and just as God has his servants, such is also true for Satan. But there's been some binding as far as the devil's helpers. Some have used this verse to conclude that hell was not originally designed for people. Now, if that's a thought that you've not had before, this may be something that takes a little bit to process. But Jesus specifically says the place called hell was designated for the devil and his angels. So then the question becomes, did God intend for mankind to ever go to hell? I can't, once again, be definitive on this point, but I lean towards the idea, and we also discussed this at the preacher's meeting last Monday, that hell, as some writers have described it, is God's fallback position. When you begin to think about this, how many does God want to perish? 2 Peter 3:9.
No.
All right. He doesn't want a single one to perish. So his ideal will then would have been for what? You know, let's not have hell. Because what's my goal? Everybody is going to spend eternity with me. We know, though, going back to what Ray mentioned just a few minutes ago, as far as Adam and Eve and some others, people have made some bad choices. Even as we look at the preceding verses, remember the story about the talents? One guy received how many talents? Five. Did he do well? Yep. Second guy receives two. Did he do well?
Yes.
Next guy, third guy receives one. Gave you the answer. And how did he do?
Yeah.
Not well. He failed. Well, it wasn't the master's fault. The master, again, gave these talents and wanted all the servants to do what was right. But there was this fella, and as we look at the Bible, Adam and Eve and many others, that have failed to do what's right. And God has to do something with them. So, as I look at this, and again, I could be very wrong, but it seems to me that hell was not made for man. But, and Ray made this point at the preacher's meeting. He came down with us Monday, and I think the thought is exactly right. He went back, as far as one illustration, to the furnace for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Why do you think the king had a furnace? Think he created that to kill people?
Maybe.
Well, that's a possibility, but I think there's something that suggests that that's not the reason, but it's possible. Why do you think the king had that furnace? All right, more than likely, I mean, we're getting to that time of year where we're going to want heat pretty soon. Do you remember the detail in that story? When it was time for those fellows to be cast into the fire, what's said about it? It was heated 7 times hotter. Well, what does that suggest about the purpose of the furnace? All right, it wasn't normally used in that way. This was a special circumstance. So you have here a device, in this case a furnace, presumably used to heat up a room or heat up the place where the king was living. But even though this was the purpose for it, you find that it was also able to be used to, in the king's mind, kill these guys, which that didn't work out. And we have a lot of things like that today, don't we? We talk about a multi-purpose tool. You know, somebody's got a screwdriver, but they also need a hammer. So, I mean, turn it over and just start, you know, banging with the end and so forth. And that is my thinking as far as hell. It was not made for man, but it is a place where the unsaved are going to go, even though that was not really the place designed for man. There was that fellowship aspect. One writer, and I think this is a good statement, describe hell as a cosmic disposal place for God. Now think about that. It is a cosmic disposal. It is a cosmic dump. It's a cosmic garbage disposal. And if you think about it from that perspective, you remember from the book of Revelation, chapter 20, verse 14, what's going to be tossed into hell or the lake of fire? Two things are mentioned there. Anybody remember what they are? Very good. Death and Hades are also going to be dumped into hell. Why? You know, people are not going to die anymore, but there's no more use for it, and it's not a positive thing. So send it where? Off to the cosmic garbage dump. So again, don't think it was really designed for man, but it was this disposal place, and if the unsaved are not willing to make things right, then they are going to be sent there. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say some more things? Don?
Are you saying that God did not intend for hell to be a place where you send the unsaved?
Jesus says in 41, hell was prepared for the devil and his angels. I know that for sure. He doesn't mention man. I can't find anything in the Bible that says hell was designed for man. I can find some statements, though, that say that God has wanted to have fellowship with man, wanted to be in a good relationship with man. God doesn't want anybody to perish. So as I look at those things, that inclines me to think that, as I mentioned before, it is God's fallback position. In other words, the people who do not enter into a right relationship with God, whether they choose that or through ignorance, whatever it is, they've got to go somewhere. And God says, this place has been prepared for the devil and his angels. The unsaved people have to go somewhere. They're also going to go here.
The unsaved people, when they die, go to Hades, correct?
Yes.
On the other side, at least we know that, where they suffer the torment. Mm-hmm. When it says here it's prepared, is that future? I mean, does hell exist someplace now?
It seems to me, if you let's go back and take a look at 41 again. Yes, and an additional sub-point here. Then shall I also say unto them on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into the eternal fire. That's a reference to hell. And then when he uses that word prepared, do you want to take a stab at what the verb tense is? Perfect. Now that to me is also significant. And there have been some people who have done some interesting thinking along this line. Hell was prepared in the past. And by using the perfect tense, Jesus says hell continues to exist at the present time. Let me make a couple more points, if you just hold on to your thought for just a second. Now, when was hell created? I don't know. Some people have suggested, as you go back and you look at the days of creation, if you go back and look at day two, I believe it is, the Bible doesn't say on that day, and everything that was created was good. Because that day lacks that specific point. Some people have said, well, hell must have been created on the second day. I have some doubts about that because it sounds like, you know, in the book of Genesis, we're dealing with material things as far as man and his world and not hell. It would make more sense to me, you know, if hell was created sometime, you know, prior to the foundation of the world. Unless God, in his foreknowledge, said that, angels are going to sin, therefore I'm going to create hell now. That's a possibility. It could be that the angels fell, and God says there's got to be some eternal place for them to go. So hell is going to be a spot, you know, that I create, and it still takes you back to either the foundation of the world or sometime before it. And I guess I would put it in that particular time frame as far as a general period of time. But it has existed. It's going to continue to exist. And then the other thing here that gets really interesting. Remember from 2 Peter chapter 3, what's Peter say about things as we know them? Lord's going to come back, and what's going to happen to the heavens, the earth, and everything else? All going to be burned up. Well, now, if that's going to be true, I'm wondering about hell. It's got to continue somehow, right? Because Jesus says you're going to go there if you're among the unsaved, and how long are you going to be there? You've got to be there forever, and it's been prepared in the past. So, as everything is burned up, 2 Peter chapter 3, hell is either a state, and I'm, again, kind of doing a little guessing here as far as some interpretation, but it seems to be that it's more of a state than a place. But even if it is a place instead of a state, or maybe it's a combination of both, it still has to exist when everything goes out of existence, at least everything that we know it to exist. Okay, three or four hands. Don, we'll take you because you started it.
So basically, hell hell is not occupied currently.
That would be the conclusion that I would come to.
Okay, and the devil and his angels are not in hell currently.
That's my understanding. Some people would have the belief that some of his angels, for example, when Peter talks about, let's just look at it.
Well, let me follow up with another question.
Okay.
If they're not in hell, they're not in torment.
Well, now, I don't know that you would say that because there could be some intermediate state, if you will. So, like I say, I don't know that I would.
The devil must not be in eternal torment right now, or he must not believe that he'll ever end up there. He wouldn't pursue the course he's pursuing.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that he could overcome God. So, it's a futile effort on his part.
Yeah, it is. It is.
If he suffered that punishment already.
Yeah. It becomes a little more complicated when you begin to think about Satan's forces, if you will. Does he have access to his full force, all the evil angelic demons? You know, there are a couple things in the book of Revelation that make me wonder about that a little bit, plus Peter's statement that, you know, when he talks about angels being confined, is that confinement temporary? Is that confinement partial? In other words, if he has 100,000 angels, does God say you can have 50,000 of them to actively work on the earth, the other 50,000 are going to be contained? You know, there are a lot of interesting questions that you just have to take a little bit of Bible information and try to extract from that some conclusions. And some of them it just gets really iffy on. So, like I say, you can throw some things out here and try to reason some things out, but at the end of the day, we're still on some ground that some people are not going to agree on and some ground that's a little shaky. So, but those are some really interesting questions and, like I say, some things that sometimes get tossed around. Harvey, I think maybe you next, and then we'll take Steve and then probably Brian.
Jesus said he was prepared for the devil. The devil out before Garden of Eden.
Right.
So there's already been a place prepared before that.
Yeah. Again, that I think is a conclusion that I would be on board with, but trying to nail that down, you're taking some passages there and trying to extract from that some conclusions, so they make sense. Right, they make sense, but to actually stake very much on them, I'm going to be a little hesitant there. Steve?
Well, if I'm reading this right, I'm going to start in 2 Peter 2:4. It talks about,
there again, like I say, you can go back and you can take a few passages and try to extract from that some conclusions, but
just the way they said it, order like that.
Yeah.
If I'm reading it right, it's before the beginning of time?
Well, the angels that were evil angels apparently sinned prior to the time. You know, 1 Timothy 3, about verse 8, talks about, you know, elders and pride and so forth. Falling into the snare of the devil. So there seems to have been some issue with pride on the devil's part. Was that maybe as the world was being created, before the world was created? Again, there's just not a whole lot of information there. I do think, though, in the translation that you read from, if you have footnotes there, you'll see Tartarus is maybe a footnote. And, you know, translators have gone back and forth on that. Tartarus is a place that we, once again, don't have a lot of information about. Some people, and I'm inclined to take this view, but once again, I can't be definitive on it. Some think that Tartarus would refer to the Hadean realm that Don made reference to in Luke 16, and it would be on that side where you have the unrighteous, and that's a possibility. Others think of Tartarus as hell. But when he talks about, you know, along with Jude 6, the angels being confined there, you get back into how many are confined? All of them, some of them, was the confinement permanent? Does God maybe allow Satan at various times to go down there and pull from that force? Just a lot of interesting questions that I really wish we had some answers to. But if somebody has those answers, it's, you know, beyond my knowledge base. Brian?
I was reminded of the time when Jesus was casting out the demons.
Yeah.
They said that they requested, or asked him, not to
torment them before the time.
Before the time. So they knew what their ultimate end was. I don't know what place was in their mind, but they knew what was coming.
Yeah, they did. And that still ties into some of the things that were asked. Were these, if some demons are confined still in Tartarus, were these maybe among the demons that would be allowed to roam the earth and do Satan's bidding?
Before the time.
Right. And when that time comes, the end of time, then they and all the others are going to really suffer. There have been some other suggestions here that are very interesting. For example, when you think about what Jesus did at the cross, one idea that's been proposed is that God let some demons continue to roam the earth, but the worst demons, excluding Satan, were going to be limited. They were going to be among those who were chained. Maybe the creatures that were involved with possessing people. That's a possibility. I mean, I can't prove that. I can't disprove that. But there are just a lot of things about what's taking place as far as the demonic force. We do, I think, have to recognize 1 Peter 5:8. Remember, the devil is like a roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour. And he still has his helpers. Some of them are human. Some of them would be angelic. But does he have access to all of his helpers? I don't know. Could we prove that each demon is as evil? Doesn't Matthew talks about the demon that goes to the waterless places, comes back to the house, it's swept and garnished. And doesn't that passage say he brought spirits that were more evil? Let's see if we can find that.
More evil.
Yeah, I was thinking it was Matthew 12, but let's see if we can locate that really quick. Somebody has a concordance, maybe look up the word waterless.
43.
Is it Matthew 12, 43? Okay, let's pick up with 41. The men of Nineveh shall stand up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, a greater one than Jonah is here. The queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here. But the unclean spirit, when he is gone out of the man, passes through waterless places, seeking rest, and findeth it not. Then he saith, I will return unto my house whence I came out, and when he cometh, he findeth it empty, swept, and garnished. Then goeth he and taketh with him seven other spirits. There it is. It's Matthew 12:45. More evil than himself. Now to me, that would indicate that when we think about demonic spirits, there is a level, there are levels, there are degrees of wickedness and evilness among them. And if you think about what was mentioned just a moment ago, that maybe some of those especially evil spirits that possessed people and did some other things, maybe they've been chained, maybe they've been confined in less evil spirits, if you will, which doesn't mean that they're good. But these other spirits may be allowed to work with Satan and not have perhaps quite the degree of power some of the others would. So again, you just get some subtle hints and some brief statements like this, and in reading between the lines, drawing some tentative conclusions. Anybody else? Betty?
Back to talking about, we didn't know when hell was prepared. And if you didn't think it was prepared for man. I know he says in the Matthew there, it prepared the devil and his angels. But God is all knowing. He writes your name in the book of life. Mm-hmm. So he knows whether you're going to be in heaven or hell, or whether you're not. He's known that from the beginning.
Right.
So if he knows that about us, wouldn't he know the same about the devil and his angels?
I think you have to take that position, because Paul talks about, for example, you know, and Peter too. Peter refers to Jesus as the Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. Paul, in the book of Ephesians, several times, you know, talks about God's mystery, that is the plan of redemption, the way to save man. Once again, how it was prepared from the foundation of the world. Well, if you need to redeem something, there's a problem. So he knew that man would have the problem of sin. And again, this might be cutting things, you know, very narrowly. But at least in my mind, I would draw a distinction between God says, this is my plan for hell. It's for the devil and his angels. It is this cosmic garbage dump, if you will. But also in the back of his mind, he knew, if you will, that there would be some people who would reject his plan. There would need to be a place for them as well. And the plan was, this was not the reason that hell was created, but this place is a spot for things like death, Hades, Satan, his angels, and for the unsaved people, this is always going to be, this will also be their eternal spot. They're going to spend eternity there. So yes, I don't think that we would want to ever put God in a position where we say, well, this was just an afterthought. He thought, well, I need some place for these guys to go, and let's see, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, let's just send them over here to hell. But at the same time, it wasn't the focus for hell. The focus was for Satan and his angels, and a secondary. And that's why I use that expression, God's fallback position. He said, they've got to go somewhere, and my will is going to be that they go to hell. So, any other thoughts on that? Okay, like I say, it's a lot to wrestle with, and there are just a lot of things to kick around, but at the end of the day, we've got limited information in the Scriptures. Don?
Well, that would make sense if hell was created before earth was created, before man was created. That would make sense, then.
I don't know of any reason why it would not. But, again, trying to go back and figure out it, we don't even know when Satan fell. Exactly. Was it before the creation started? That I can't answer. Was it maybe before one of the days of creation, before man was, brought to the planet? I don't know. But yes, I think that conclusion is one that we can definitely sustain, because there was the fall. Otherwise, Satan would not have tempted them. That's a good philosophical question. As far as a good Bible answer, I do not have one. Some people have suggested things like, and this falls into the category of forgiveness of sins. If you are buying some jewelry, taking a lady in and, looking at a wedding ring or an anniversary ring or an engagement ring, what would the jeweler do? He's just going to lay that ring down in a glass case? All right. And what's he going to do? Where does he put that oftentimes? Might slip it on the finger. What's the old jeweler's trick? What's he put on? Some cloth, some velvet. That's what color?
Black.
Black. Why? They got the lights above, and when that diamond is put in that black felt, what's it do? Looks like $1 million. A similar thing might be true in the spiritual realm. To show God's righteousness and holiness, what do you bring in? The very opposite. And maybe that's part of the answer. At least, I don't know, but there is going to, we talk about the difference between day and night and so forth, and maybe that's one of the things where heavenly creatures, and certainly at the end of time, people will be able to say and understand why there has to be that separation. Because this is sin, this is evil, this is ugliness, and God says, this is who I am. These are my qualities. Anybody else? All right. Well, don't run off the road tonight when you go home thinking about this stuff. All right. Let's see. Well, that's 5 minutes. Sherman, we may not get to your question tonight, but if not tonight, we will do our best to pick it up next week. 42-46. For I was hungry, and you did not give me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and you visited me not. Then shall they also answer, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungry, or athirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it unto one of these least, ye did it unto me. And these shall go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. There are a lot of ways that a person can miss out on heaven. In some cases, Paul said, as he wrote to the Thessalonians, people did not know about God. And that's going to, because they sinned, they were not in a right relationship with God, they're going to be cast away. Other people, 1 Thessalonians 1 verse 9, they were involved with false religion. Paul talked about idolatry. Or they may not be involved with any religion at all. Some, as Jesus taught in the parable of the sower, there are people who hear, and even though they hear, and maybe even they believe, They do not ever obey the gospel. Others believe and they do obey, but they decide that they're going to try to serve God in their own way. There are other people who do become a Christian. They fail to labor. They fail to work in the kingdom. And this is also going to result in the loss of salvation. Jesus described the problem back in Matthew 7. He said, narrow is the gate that leads to life, but wide, broad, is the way that leads to destruction. And here in the final verses of this chapter, Jesus talks about some of the things that will cause people to end up on the road that leads to destruction. You do have some people, and I think Jesus is talking about Christians here, because as Don mentioned earlier, the word brethren or brother is used in the passage. So if we're thinking about people from the Christian era, these would be people who had been baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of their sins. But even though they did the right things as far as how to become a Christian, what did they do with their lives? Who did they live for?
Themselves.
They didn't live for God. They had various opportunities to work, various opportunities to serve in various ways, but they failed. It's interesting to me as you look at 42 through 46, and then you go back and look at 35 through 36, you find the things that the righteous did are also mentioned with the unrighteous. The same activities. But the righteous did the activities that are listed. The unrighteous people did not. It all goes back really to seeking first the kingdom of God. That's going to be a lifelong process. And as you go back through and you look at these things, Jesus, well, okay, let me reword the question. Where does it say that the unrighteous people killed somebody?
It doesn't
say that. They were guilty of theft and murder.
It doesn't say that.
Doesn't say that. We oftentimes, I think, expect the unsaved to be those folks that are doing all those terrible things. That's not what we find. And they will be lost. There's no doubt about that. But that's not what we find in Matthew 25. Here were people who were supposed to live as a Christian. And they failed. And these failures, they're not big responsibilities, are they? Giving somebody some clothes. Giving somebody a cold drink. Making a visit to somebody. People sometimes might consider those things to be relatively earth-shattering. Are you kidding me? But the Lord presents these as basic responsibilities. And they're things that are associated with living for Christ. As you look at verse 44, there's the word translated minister. And that describes the work of deacons. 1 Timothy 3, verses 10 through 13. And that tells us that when we look at life, there's a lot to living the Christian life. Paul described it in Romans 12, verse 1. Remember, I beseech you therefore, brethren, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Well, these people in Matthew 25 had failed to do that. So Jesus says that they are going to receive eternal punishment. One of the things that I do want to mention quickly here, and we may take just a couple of extra minutes to kind of see if we can get at least some of what Sherman had asked about. There are people who, as they think about hell, they say it's not going to be eternal. And they likely do this because that's troubling to them, or they know somebody that's probably headed there. One problem with that is the word that is translated eternal life, that word eternal, it is the same word that describes eternal punishment. So if you take that word eternal as far as a punishment and you say that this doesn't mean forever, logically you're also bound to do what? Then you've got to say the same thing about eternal life. So what cuts one way cuts the other way as well. When we think about hell, and I'm going to give you some quick things here because it doesn't look like we've got anybody coming in quite yet. We know that Jesus was involved in the creation of hell, don't we? Colossians 1 verse 16 says he created everything. Creation was done through him. So if hell is a prepared, if it is a created place, he was involved with it. And that may help account for why he mentions it so often in the Bible, because he knows exactly what it's like. He said hell is for those who fail to bring forth good fruit, Matthew 7, verse 19. And if you think back to Matthew 3, 11 and 12, Jesus is described by John the Baptist as someone who's going to baptize people, how? With fire, or in fire. So back there, as John the Baptist was telling about Jesus, he described him as a baptizer of fire. We have the book of Revelation 19:20 describing hell as a lake of fire. People are going to suffer there day and night forever and ever. Revelation 20:10. The people who are not in the book of life are going to go there. Revelation 20 verse 15. And we know from Hebrews 9:27 that after a person dies, their eternal judgment is going to be forever. There's not going to be anything that can be changed. Now, hell, as you look at it, is really described as the opposite of everything that God is all about. And that, to me, suggests that hell is going to be bad because, as I said, it's the very reverse of the things associated with God. Matthew 25, verse 41, we pointed out there how the people who go to hell will be permanently severed from the Lord. And that's significant. Remember 1 John 4:8, God is love. Well, if hell's the opposite, what's not going to be there? Love. God's light. Remember 1 John 1, verse 5? But when you think about hell, it's described in what terms? It's a place of darkness. And then you see, as well, God offers rest to people. Revelation 14, verse 13. But what's hell going to be? There is no rest day and night. Hell is a place of blackness instead of a place of light. And, you know, when we think about God, His offer is joy and peace and so forth. But what's the impression of hell from what we find? How much joy? How much peace? There is none. So when God says, depart from me, ye cursed, it seems to me to be a way of indicating that everything is going to, as far as hell is concerned, be the exact opposite of what people want. Then I want to give you this information quickly as well. How many main senses do people have? Main senses. Five. We've got the ability to touch, taste, smell, and so forth. And as you look at the Bible, hell is associated with all five of these senses. When you think about fire, you can touch fire, right? Again, that may not be literal, and I think, Sherman, that may have been one of the things that you're describing. How literal is hell? I don't know. But it is described with the word fire, and it's not, you're out there cooking marshmallows and hot dogs, so not a very positive. Then when you think about the aspect of taste, remember Luke 16:24, as Jesus talks about the negative side of the Hadean realm, taste, associated there in the text or not? This fellow wanted just a little water on his tongue. Then when you think about sight and smell, how would you associate that with hell? Sight and smell. Well, okay, what about smoke? Sight, hard to see. The smell, the brimstone, and so forth. And then when you think about the ability to hear, Jesus describes hell as the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. So five senses, five main senses that we have, and we find Bible passages that associate hell with each one of those senses to give us the impression that whatever that's like, it is going to be the most undesirable place that has ever existed, and it's going to be an eternal state for people.